Well, it's a pleasure to be here. This isn't the first time I've been at the University of Minnesota, nor even the first time that I've lectured, I think this is right, in connection with McLuhan Institute. It's a pleasure to be here again, even if it is a bit chilly, or was a bit chilly this morning. This lecture is called Against Materialism, and I hope you all have a copy of the handout or have access to sit next to somebody that's got one. I think that'll make life easier if you do. But before I actually start the lecture, I should perhaps say a word about my philosophical method. You know, philosophers, and I'm a philosopher, philosophers are very much concerned about method. Some people might even say philosophers obsess about method, or are obsessed with the idea of method. Maybe that's true. But I want to tell you a little story about method, which will illustrate my own method. I'm a graduate of a college in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Calvin College. Maybe some of you have heard of this in Grand Rapids, Michigan. My father's also a graduate of this college. And when he was a student there, there was a man named Feike Feikema, who was also a student. Feike Feikema was from Iowa. And Feike Feikema wrote novels about what he called Siouxland, which was Minnesota, in particular the western edge of western part of Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa. That was what he called Siouxland. So he wrote novels with titles like The Golden Bowl and Lord Grizzly and The Green Earth and so on. Anyway, Feike Feikema, after a while, changed his name to Frederick Manfred because he didn't think the Eastern establishment of critics would take seriously somebody with a name like Feike Feikema. So he changed it to Frederick Manfred. And now, you might not think that's exactly an improvement. I'm not sure how much of an improvement that is. But at any rate, Feike or Frederick one time got a hold of one of my books. I think it's one that's for sale out there, actually, God, Freedom, and Evil, just a little thin book. And he read this book. And this book has got numbered propositions in it, P's and Q's. It's sort of logical, maybe too logical. Anyway, Feike got a hold of that book, and he read it, and he wrote me about it, and he said he really enjoyed that book, and he really admired my method, my sort of careful, rigorous, step-by-step, logical, clear, analytic method. He said it's really a wonderful method. He said he liked it almost as well as his own method, which was just guessing. So much for method. Now, this lecture is on the topic of materialism. It's part of a larger piece of work. The larger piece of work you might call Against Naturalism. This part is Against Materialism. The larger work is, you could call, Against Naturalism. It's not that I want to name everything I write against something or other. That sounds a bit maybe unduly negative. I should write something for something or other, too. But in any event, I take it naturalism is the idea that there's no such person as God or anything at all like God. That's what naturalism is. So naturalism is, you might say, stronger than atheism. You could be an atheist without being a naturalist, but you couldn't be a naturalist without being an atheist. If you were a follower of the young Hegel, for example, maybe you thought there was such a thing as Hegel's absolute, then you could be an atheist. You might think, well, there's this absolute. There isn't God, but there is this absolute. Then you'd be an atheist, but you wouldn't be a naturalist. So naturalism, as I say, is stronger than atheism. And secondly, in this larger project, I've got sort of three separate arguments against naturalism. One of these three separate arguments is one I gave here maybe 10 years ago. And I was thinking of giving that one again, but then I thought some of you might have been here 10 years ago, and you might have heard enough of that argument. So this is a different one. And this particular argument is against materialism, which I take it isn't really entailed by naturalism. I don't know if you absolutely have to be a materialist if you're a naturalist, but at any rate, the truth is nearly all naturalists are materialists. I don't know of any naturalists who aren't. So I take it they're at least very closely connected. And when I speak of materialism here, I don't mean the idea that everything there is made of matter. I don't mean that. That would certainly That would be incompatible with theism, certainly. I don't mean that. I just mean the idea that human beings are material objects, all right? Maybe there are some other immaterial objects. Maybe there are things like numbers and propositions and, I don't know, states of affairs and sets which are not material objects. But human beings, at any rate, according to materialism, are material objects. So a human being doesn't have an immaterial soul, isn't an immaterial self, but rather a human being is a material object. Her body or her brain or some other part of her body, something like that. That's what materialism is. And as I say, it's associated with naturalism, and in this paper I want to argue against it. I think the reason that naturalists tend to be against, tend to support materialism is that it's really hard to, there's several different reasons. One reason might be just this. A naturalist might think that an immaterial self or substance would just be too much like God. If you're a naturalist, you'd think there's no such person as God nor anything very much like God. That would be one possibility. Another would be that you might find it really hard to see how such a thing could have evolved. How could something like an immaterial self or substance or ego have evolved? You know, evolution works by way of natural selection, winnowing sources of genetic variation, so you get some kind of variation, let's say some sort of a random genetic mutation. You get a slightly different kind of organism. Maybe that slightly different kind of organism does better in that environment than others. Maybe in this way that change that gets passed on, this new trait. But it's hard to see how, by virtue of some random genetic mutation, a soul might arise. How would that happen? That's pretty hard to figure out. So at any rate, most naturalists are materialists. But the fact is, there are also a number of Christian philosophers nowadays who are materialists. There might be more Christian philosophers who are materialists about human beings now than there have ever been in the past. I suspect there probably are. I mean, I haven't done any kind of scientific study, and it might be a little hard to figure out how to do a scientific study, but that's my guess. There's some names of Christian philosophers there who are materialists on the sheet. Peter Van Inwagen, Lynn Rutter Baker, Trenton Merricks, who was a PhD student of mine, if you can imagine that. I mean, here he became a materialist. Well, what can I say? Kevin Corcoran, Cliff Williams, and many more. Now, in this talk, I want to do two things, a double project. First, I want to offer a particular philosophical objection to materialism. There are several philosophical objections to materialism, but I'm just going to concentrate on one. And second, I want to argue that Christian philosophers should reject materialism. They should be instead substance dualists, where a substance dualist is someone who thinks that a human being is an immaterial self or an immaterial substance related in a certain way, in a certain very intimate way, to a body, to a human body. All right? That's my project. Well, next, in a nutshell, I could say what my problem with materialism is, the next little bit down there. From the perspective of materialism, there is a real problem with two sorts of things, at least. Mental properties, like being conscious, being in pain. There are such properties as being in pain. Unfortunately, many of us have exemplified that property. There's also the property of being conscious. And fortunately, most of us here at the moment do exemplify that property. At least I hope so. There are such properties on the one hand. And then on the other hand, there are mental acts, such things as beliefs, desires or desirings, hoping, hopes, and so on. Two kinds of things, mental properties and mental acts. I think there's a real difficulty for materialism with respect to both of those, but I'm going to talk just about the latter, about beliefs, desires, hopes, and so on. The former are just as vexing for materialism, but I'll just talk about the latter. So beliefs and desires and hopes and fears, these are what philosophers call propositional attitudes. They're attitudes you take towards a proposition. Consider the proposition, there's a dog in my house. All right? Well, I might believe that proposition. I might think, yeah, there's a dog in my house. I might hope that this proposition was true. I might hope that there's a dog in my house. I might fear this proposition. I might fear that there's a dog in my house. I might desire that there be a dog in my house. And there are lots of other such propositional attitudes we could list if we felt like it. But at any rate, it's a propositional attitude. It's an attitude towards a proposition. And here's why I say there's a real problem here for the materialist. The problem is, it seems to me, that if materialism were true, there wouldn't be any such things as desires. There wouldn't be any such things as hopes. There wouldn't be any such things in particular as beliefs. There wouldn't be these propositional attitudes if materialism were in fact true. And I want to concentrate here on beliefs. So next to the last little bit there on the left-hand column on the first page, the problem is that there's no sensible way to think about belief from the perspective of materialism. The materialist should really be an eliminativist. He should say there aren't any beliefs. And I take it this is not trivial. I mean, it seems to me if there's anything that's obvious about human beings, it's that they believe things. But it seems to me also that if you're a materialist, you should think that there aren't any beliefs. You should be instead an eliminativist. You should think instead that, as eliminativists do think, that the whole notion of belief comes from a kind of earlier stage in our human history. It's something that grew up in our history a long time ago. It's what they call folk psychology. It should be replaced by something more scientific and up-to-date. Okay, so far so good, I hope. Okay, now, the objection I want to raise, the particular kind of objection I want to raise, isn't original with me, it's not new. It goes really all the way back to Plato in the ancient world, and it was put in a particularly striking way by the 17th century philosopher Leibniz, whom I'm sure many of you have heard of. Leibniz, 17th century philosopher Leibniz. And if you look here on the sheet, number one, it says the argument, Leibniz's problem. Here's what Leibniz says, and I'm going to call the argument I'm interested in Leibniz's problem. He says, it must be confessed, moreover, that perception, and by perception he means mental life generally, and that which depends on it, are perception and the things that depend on it, these things are inexplicable by mechanical causes, that is, by figures and motions. And supposing that there were a machine so constructed as to think, some material object that could in fact think and feel and have perception, we could conceive of this machine, you could imagine it like a brain, a human brain, as enlarged and yet preserving the same proportions so that we might enter it as into a mill. And this granted, we should only find on visiting it pieces that push against one another, pushes and pulls, but never anything by which to explain a perception. This must be sought for, therefore, in the simple substance and not in the composite or in the machine. So says Leibniz, all right, in his famous little book, Monadology. So Leibniz uses the word perception here, but he's really thinking of mental life generally, not just of seeing or smelling or hearing. And his point basically is this. Thinking, mental life generally, cannot arise by way of the mechanical interaction of parts. That's the thought. Can't arise by way of the mechanical interaction of the parts of a material object. All right? Consider a bicycle, for example. A bicycle does what it does by virtue of the mechanical interaction of its parts. So when you push down on the pedal, well, that causes the sprocket the pedal is attached to rotate. That causes a chain to move. That causes the sprocket attached to the back wheel to rotate. That causes the back wheel to rotate. That causes the bicycle to move off to go some other place. All right. So it does what it does by virtue of the mechanical interaction of its parts. Now, the same would be true for automobiles and other kinds of mechanisms, things that work by gears and pulleys and so on. Leibniz wants to say that thinking can't arise in that fashion. And I think he would also say the same for not just mechanical interaction of parts, but more generally physical interactions of parts, electricity, let's say, magnetism. He would want to say that you can't get thinking, you can't make a machine that thinks, or it can't be that a thing thinks by virtue of the physical interaction of the various parts that it has. Okay, that's his idea. So, according to current science, things like electrons and quarks are simple. Well, let's suppose that they really are simple. They don't have any parts. One also thinks that things like quarks and electrons don't think. They have interesting properties, but thinking, one thinks, is not among them. All right? So Leibniz's idea is that if a simple thing like an electron or a quark can't think, then neither will things made up of electrons and quarks be able to think by virtue of the interaction of their parts. So it won't be that, let's say quarks make up protons. A proton won't be able to think by virtue of the activity of the quarks that make it up, nor an atom by virtue of the activity of the electrons and proton that make it up, nor a molecule by virtue of the activity of the atoms that make it up, and so on. That's the thought. So he's thinking about thinking generally, but I want to now concentrate, as I said a moment ago, just on belief. And the first question I want to ask then is this question. What sort of thing would a belief be? What would a belief be from a materialist perspective? If materialism were true, what would a belief be? Well, I think about the only thing one could think of here is that a belief would be something like a long-standing neural event of some kind of event involving neurons connected together in a certain way and firing the way neurons do. So a belief would be like a congeries of neurons working together. There are lots and lots of neurons, so there can be lots and lots of different states, brain states involving neurons. If you just think of brain states involving neurons, then as it says here, there are, 100 billion neurons in a human brain, give or take a few billion, and they're connected in various ways, connected at synapses and so on. If you just think of brain state in terms of these neurons being on or off, then you wind up with an absolutely gigantic total number of brain states, something like 2 to the 100 billionth. Which is a really substantial number. So there are plenty of brain states to go around. I mean, few of us are going to have more than, say, 10 to the 100 billionth different beliefs. All right? Plenty to go around, and a belief will be something like that. That's the idea. And a belief, furthermore, then, if that's what a belief is, will have two kinds of properties. On the one hand, a belief will have neurophysiological properties, or perhaps electrochemical properties. A given belief, such a collection of neurons, such a structure, such an event, will have properties like ones that represent, say, the number of neurons involved in that particular belief, the way in which they're connected with each other, how the whole thing is structured, the rate of fire of various different parts, or even various individual neurons in this structure, in this event, the way in which that rate of fire responds to input from other such neural events. These are all, we might say, electrophysical, electrochemical properties, neurophysiological properties of a belief, right? But it's got another kind of, if it's really a belief, this thing will have another property of a totally different sort. It will also have to be the belief that P for some proposition. It'll have to be, for example, the belief that Marcel Proust is more subtle than Louis L'Amour. I don't know if you've read Louis L'Amour. Not very many people read Marcel Proust either. But the fact is Marcel Proust is way more subtle than Louis L'Amour. So if this belief, so this belief will have to be the belief that P for some proposition, like that proposition, that Proust is more subtle than Lamour, it'll have to have, we might say, a content. It'll have to have, we might say, a semantic property. It will have to have some proposition as its content. All right? And now here's my real question. Here's the question. How can it happen that an assemblage of neurons firing away in a certain fashion, how can it happen that it has a content? How can it happen that it gets connected with a certain proposition in a certain way? What makes this particular belief, what makes it connected with a proposition, which is in fact the proposition that this belief is the belief in, so to speak? How can this be? All we've got here is a bunch of neurons. They're clicking away, they're firing and so on. Somehow they get connected with a certain proposition. How can that be? So look at the next little bit there on the left-hand column on the second page. I say we can examine this neuronal event as carefully as we please. We can measure the number of neurons it contains and their connections, their rates of fire, the strength of the electrical impulses involved, the potential across the synapses. We can do all this with as much precision as you could possibly desire. We can consider its electrochemical and neurophysiological properties in the most exquisite detail. But nowhere here will we find even so much as a hint of content. Nowhere here will we find even so much as a hint that this particular group of neurons is related in that content way to that proposition about Louis L'Amour and Marcel Proust. I mean, why would it be that proposition as opposed to, say, the proposition that Louis L'Amour is more subtle than Proust? There's no suggestion. No matter how carefully you look at these things, you get not so much as a hint of its having content. As a matter of fact, the properties that we're talking about, these electrochemical and neurophysiological properties, seem totally irrelevant to its having content. They're just not the right sort of thing. All right? So I say here, the fact is we can't see how it could have a content. That's the fact of the matter. It's not that we see or know that this is perfectly possible, but we just don't know how it's done. I mean, I don't really know how an automatic transmission works. So in a way, I don't see how it works. But it's not that that I can see somehow that it can't work. That's not the case. It's rather I just don't know how it does work. When you take a look at something, then there's a whole cascade of electrochemical activity that goes on in your retina and then in the optic nerve and so on. And again, one doesn't know how all that works. But in this case, it's different. In this case, it's not just that you don't know how it is that this collection of neurons clicking away, it's not just that you don't know how it manages to have a content, it's rather that you can't see how it could. It's more like what you can really see is that it can't. You can see at least dimly. As a matter of fact, that's not possible. Take a little look at the next little bit. We can't see how such an event could have content. That is, it seems upon reflection that it couldn't. In the same way that it seems upon reflection, let's say, that the number 7 couldn't weigh 5 pounds. I mean, how could that happen? It couldn't be that the number 7 should weigh 5 pounds. It's obvious that it couldn't. All right. Now, I don't say that it's as obvious as that, that this bunch of neurons assembled together, connected in that way, couldn't have a content. I don't say it's as obvious as that, but I do say that if you think about it, you can see that that's, in fact, the way things are. It's simply not the right kind of thing. In the same way, it's obvious, let's say, the next little bit there, obvious that an elephant couldn't be a proposition. Again, I don't say it's as obvious that a bunch of neurons couldn't have a content, but it's the same kind of situation. You can see to at least some degree that this can't happen. Okay. Well, now, look at the right-hand column on the second page. Here's an objection. So I'll read this objection. The objector says, quote, "You say we can't see how a neural event can have content, but in fact we understand this perfectly well. and something similar happens all the time. For there is, after all, the computer analogy. A computer, of course, is a material object, an assemblage of wires and switches and relays, a hard disk, a keyboard, and so on. I can type in a sentence, let's say the sentence, "Naturalism is all the rage these days." That sentence is represented and stored on the computer's hard disk. It's done by pluses and minuses or a magnetic configuration or something else. It doesn't exactly matter. It doesn't matter exactly how it goes. Now, the sentence, "Naturalism is all the rage these days," expresses the proposition, "Naturalism is all the rage these days." These are two different things. I mean, they sound very similar. In fact, they sound exactly alike. But they're two different things. You could express that same sentence, if you look at just across in the other little column, by the German sentence, and I shouldn't really try to pronounce this because I'll just butcher it, but what the heck, among friends. Der Naturalismus ist diese Tage ganz groß in Mode. All right? So, I mean, that same sentence expresses, those two sentences express the same proposition, namely that naturalism is all the rage these days. And the sentence then, either of those two sentences, the English one or the German one, express that proposition. So that sentence, therefore, has the proposition, naturalism is all the rage these days, as its content. But then consider the analog of that sentence on the computer disk, the assemblage of pluses and minuses, let's say. Doesn't that, too, that analog, too, express the same proposition as a sentence it represents? That bit of the computer disk, therefore, has propositional content. But, of course, that bit of the computer disk is also a material object, as is any inscription of the sentence in question. Contrary to your claim, therefore, remember this is the objector objecting to me, to my claim, contrary to your claim, therefore, a material object can perfectly well have propositional content. Indeed, it happens all the time. But if a computer disk or an inscription of a sentence can have a proposition as content, why can't an assemblage of neurons? Just as a magnetic pattern has content, the proposition, naturalism is all the rage these days, has that content. So too a pattern of neuronal firing can have that proposition as content. Your claim to the contrary is completely bogus. Well, I mean, everything was fine until that last little bit. It's getting a little personal, it seems to me. But okay, that's what the objector says. Well, here's the answer. Here's what seems to me to be the answer, to speak a bit more modestly. It's true that in a certain sense the sentence does have content. The sentence, naturalism is all the rage these days. It's part of our language. And human beings are so constructed that they can use language to communicate with each other. To communicate with each other, in particular, by way of getting the other person to entertain a certain thought or to think a certain proposition. So when you say to me, naturalism is all the rage these days, you get me to think a certain proposition. You get me to think that very proposition, namely naturalism is all the rage these days. By uttering the sentence you cause me, you bring it about that I think the proposition. The way in which this sentence then has content is this way. It has it by virtue of being usable by human beings to cause other human beings to think certain thoughts. Human beings use these propositions in such a way that these sentences in such a way that they express propositions. How exactly this goes isn't known. But it's pretty clear that what you've got there is a case where a sentence has a certain kind of content just because beings like us who can, in fact, think, use it in a certain way. And a neuronal structure then would have content of that sort only if it were used by some other creature to express propositions, only if it were used by some other creature in the way in which we use sentences to express propositions. In other words, it's clear that the kind of content a sentence has is what you might call secondary or derived content. Its content is derived from the original or first-order content enjoyed by human thoughts. Okay? Okay, so it seems to me this objection fails. So at the bottom of that page, to repeat, it isn't just that we can't show how it's done, how it is that a material structure like a bunch of neurons could have content, in the way in which we can't see how the sleight of hand artist gets the pea to wind up under the middle shell. It's rather that we can see, to at least some degree, that it can't be done, just as we can see that an elephant can't be the number 7 and that the number 7 can't weigh 7 pounds. Okay. So that's basically my claim. Now I want to consider a certain objection to the claim. And this objection, the one I want to consider, is urged by a philosopher named Peter van Inwagen, who's a Christian philosopher, and a philosopher for whom I have enormous respect. So I'm going to disagree with him, but only with fear and trembling. Okay? So here's what van Inwagen says. He says, "It seems to me that the notion of a physical thing that thinks is a mysterious notion, and that Leibniz's thought experiment, the one that we've just gone through, brings out this mystery very effectively. Now, I've been using Leibniz's argument, which says there's a real problem with the idea of a material thing thinking, as an argument against materialism and therefore for substance dualism." All right? But of course, it's a good argument if there isn't a similar difficulty for substance dualism. I mean, suppose there's the same difficulty for it, then the fact that there's this problem with materialism doesn't mean one should be a dualist. It just means you're going to be confused. You're not going to know what to think. All right? And here's what van Inwagen says. He says, "For it is thinking itself that is the source of the mystery of a thinking physical thing." What's the problem with a thinking physical thing? Basically, it's just thinking. The notion of a non-physical thing that thinks is, I would argue, equally mysterious. How any sort of thing could think is a mystery. It's just that it's a bit easier to see that thinking is a mystery, when we suppose that the thing that does the thinking is physical. For we can form mental images of the operations of a physical thing, and we can see that the physical interactions represented in these images, the only interactions that can be represented in these images, have no connection with thought or sensation, or at least none we're able to imagine or conceive or articulate. The only reason we do not readily find the notion of a non-physical thing that thinks equally mysterious is that we have no clear procedure for forming mental images of non-physical things. Okay, so here's the real problem, he says. The problem with material objects thinking is that we can't form a mental image of a material object's thinking. We can't form a mental image of what it is for this material object, this bunch of neurons, to be thinking or feeling. All right? That's the thought. But, he says, the very same thing goes for an immaterial object. You also can't form a mental image of an immaterial thing thinking. That's just as hard. So he says there's really parity here. It's not that there's any good reason here for rejecting materialism, because it's just as hard to imagine an immaterial thing thinking as it is to imagine a material thing thinking. Okay? That's the van Inwagen objection. Well, now here's our question. Is van Inwagen right? And as I say, only with fear and trembling and trepidation and various other things of that sort, all of which I won't mention, only with fear and trembling do I disagree with him. But I do disagree with him. It seems to me he's mislocated the problem. Why is it that I think a material object can't think? Well, it isn't really because I can't form a mental image of a material object thinking. There are lots of states of affairs such that I can't form mental images of them where I don't think there's any impossibility at all. I can't form a mental image of a proposition. I can't form a mental image of a set having members. But I certainly don't think it's impossible that there be a proposition or impossible that sets should have members. Sets obviously do have members. Whether or not you can form a mental image here is, it seems to me, for the most part, irrelevant. So, for example, and look just below there, He says nothing could possibly count as a mental image of a thinking thing. Well, that's maybe so, but that seems to me not to be of any significance. Descartes talked about a chelaiagon, a thousand-sided rectilinear plane figure. He said you can't form a mental image of that. Quite right. But that doesn't mean you should think there can't be any chelaiagons. The fact that you can't form an image of the number 17s being prime doesn't for a minute suggest that 17 couldn't be prime. All right? So that's not the problem. I don't think that a proposition or a set could be read. Propositions and sets aren't the right kind of thing to be read. But it's not because I can't form a mental image of a proposition or a set's being read. That's not how it happens at all. So there are two separate problems here, it seems to me. The first is that not being able to form a mental image of something is not a reason for thinking that there couldn't be a thing like that. And the second is that the problem with respect to a material object's thinking is not that one can't form a mental image of it, but that one can see to at least some degree that it can't be so, that it can't happen. All right? So, for example, I can't form a mental image of a proposition's having members, sets have members. I can't form a mental image of a proposition's having members, but I also can't form a mental image of a set's having members. And the reason I reject the idea that a proposition should have members, then, is not that I can't form a mental image of it, but that I can see that a proposition isn't the right sort of thing to have members. It isn't the right sort of thing to do that. All right? That's the thought so far. Okay. So now I'm on the second column on the third page, at least in the version I've got here. So the same thing goes with a physical thing's thinking. True, one can't imagine it. The reason for rejecting the idea, however, is not that one can't imagine it. It's rather that one can see that a physical object just isn't the right sort of thing to do that kind of thing to think. And I think Benenwagen is prepared, he might be prepared to concede this. At least in another place, he says this. He says, Leibniz's thought experiment shows that when we carefully examine the idea of a material thing having sensuous properties, thinking, for example, it seems to be an impossible idea. All right? That's a very different thought from saying you can't imagine it. That it seems to be impossible, that's very different from saying you can't imagine it. And it seems to be impossible part that really counts. That's why it seems to me, that a material object can't think. And a little further down there, and the same doesn't go for an immaterial thing's thinking. We certainly can't see that no immaterial thing can think. If we could, we'd have an argument against the existence of God. It would go like this. No immaterial thing can think. If there were such a person as God, he would be both immaterial and a thinker. Therefore, there's no such person as God. But that's clearly not a sensible argument. Okay. Well, there is another objection that Benenwagen gives, and I'd like to go over this one a little bit more rapidly so that I have a little bit of time at the end here to talk about materialism and Christian belief more specifically. So far, I'm just talking about a certain philosophical objection to materialism. His second objection there at the bottom third page? He says, in general, to attempt to explain how an underlying reality generates some phenomenon is to construct a representation of the working of that underlying reality, a representation that in some sense shows how the underlying reality generates the phenomenon. Essentially the same considerations as those that show that we are unable to form a mental image that displays the generation of thought and sensation by the workings of some underlying reality, whether the underlying reality involves one thing or many, and whether the things it involves are physical or non-physical, this show that we are unable to form any sort of representation that displays the generation of thought and sensation by the workings of an underlying reality. Well, that's a little bit opaque, but here I think the thought is we can't form some idea with respect to a material object of how the underlying reality, by virtue of the way it fits together or works together, actually brings about the thinking. And he wants to say the same thing goes for an immaterial self, or a soul, a thing that thinks. He wants to say in the same way there, you can't form a representation to yourself of how it is that by the workings of the underlying reality of a self or a soul, thinking arises. All right? That's the thought. Well, here's what seems to me to be the answer to that objection. Again, offered with fear and trembling, etc. If you think that a human being is a self or a soul, as I do think, you'll think that such a thing doesn't have any parts. It's simple. It doesn't have any parts. And it doesn't do what it does by virtue of the way in which its parts work together, because it just doesn't have any parts. It's a basic activity of cells. It's not done by virtue of anything else that the self does, and it's an immediate activity of the self. It's both basic and immediate. So to ask the question, how does a self produce thought? I mean, how does that go exactly? How does it arise out of its underlying reality? That's really to ask an improper question. There isn't any how about it. It's done immediately. It's done directly, not by virtue of doing something else. Consider the electron again, which is said to be simple. Well, electrons have charge, and they also have location. You might say, how does an electron do a thing like that? By virtue of what does it have a charge? Well, there isn't any answer to that question. It doesn't have any parts, so it's not by virtue of how its parts work together. Electrons are just the kind of thing that do that. They have that sort of thing, as you might say, as an immediate property. Such a thing like that is just the kind of thing an electron is. And the same thing goes, I'm saying, for minds or cells on the one hand and thought on the other hand. So here a little further. True, thought can seem sometimes to be mysterious. Van Inwagen emphasizes the mystery of thought, and wonderful, but of course propositions and sets are mysterious and wonderful too. Propositions, consider propositions, they are about things. And they're true or false. How do they manage to do that? How do they get to be true or false? How do they get to be about something? They also stand in logical relations. Again, you might say, how do they do that? You know, isn't that marvelous and amazing and so on and so on? Well, maybe it is marvelous and amazing, but there's no answer to the question how they do it. It's just their nature to be true or false, and it's just their nature to be about things. Similarly, for sets, you might say, you know, there's a set of, say, these three men sitting right here in this row, a set with three things in it. How does that set manage to have just those three? I mean, why isn't this fellow over here part of that set? Why can't I be part of that set? What is it about the set that does that? Again, the answer is there isn't anything about the set that does that. It's just the nature of that particular set to have exactly those three members. And there isn't any how, any answer to the question, how does it do it? Okay. So this next little bit here. Of course, if you begin with the idea that everything has to be a material object, then thought and propositions and sets would indeed be mysterious and paradoxical. But why should you begin that way? Why begin with that idea? Thought is seriously mysterious, I think, only when we assume that it would have to be generated in some physical way by physical interaction among physical objects. That's mysterious. Indeed, it goes far beyond mystery, all the way to apparent impossibility. But that's not a problem for thought. It's a problem for materialism. Section 3, Materialism and Christian Belief. So I say, from a philosophical perspective, dualism is superior to materialism. How does this debate look from a specifically Christian perspective? Well, I think there are four or possibly five different kinds of considerations here. And I won't take the time to go through these in detail. I don't have that much time left. I'm sure you don't want me to explain all of these in great detail. And I'm sure I don't want to explain them all in great detail. But there are four or five basic kinds of data. First, there are lots and lots of scriptural passages, so it seems on the face of it at any rate, that strongly suggest dualism and seem to go contrary to materialism. St. Paul says in more than one place that it's better to be absent from the body and present with the Lord than to be present in the body and absent from the Lord. That suggests that you and your body, you and every part of your body, are distinct objects. You're not the same thing then as your body, because it's possible to be absent from the body and present with the Lord. Jesus says to the thief on the cross, "This day you shall be in paradise with me." That can hardly be spoken of the thief's body. There are lots and lots of similar passages. And if you want to look at a really thorough examination of these passages, the thing to do is look at John Cooper's book that I mentioned there, Body, Soul, and Life Everlasting, Biblical Anthropology and the Monism-Dualism Debate. A second point of relevance here, suppose, like Van Inwagen, you think there is parity here between the thought that a material object should be able to think on the one hand and the thought that an immaterial object should be able to think on the other. You think they look equally impossible. He seems to think they both seem to be impossible. Well, if you do think that, then if you are a Christian, or even if you're just a theist, not a Christian, but any kind of theist, Jewish theist, Muslim theist, if you're a theist, a believer in God, then you know that one of those apparent impossibilities is just misleading and mistaken, because you know of at least one immaterial object that does think, namely God. All right? That's a second point of relevance. The third point of relevance. The main argument, going all the way back to Descartes, that people have used against dualism is the thought that an immaterial thing, an immaterial self or substance, could not have causal effects in the hard, heavy, massive physical world. How could this immaterial thing cause something to happen like my arm rising? How could it do a thing like that? Well, here again, if you're a believer in God, if you're a theist, then you already know of one immaterial object that can certainly have effects in the hard, massy, heavy, massive physical world, namely God, right? So that objection doesn't carry any weight at all from a Christian or a theistic perspective. The fourth sort of area of relevance that, again, I can't really get into in any detail here is this. It seems much harder to conceive of the Christian hope of immortality and afterlife from a materialist point of view. After all, if I just were my body, then, say, if I die and all the particles that constitute my body are widely scattered and so on, how is it going to be that I can arise, my body, on the last day? How can that be if I just am that body which gets destroyed, all the particles, all its parts distributed? Then it looks really hard to see how I, this very person, could arise on the day of judgment. And then finally, the last respect of relevance here would be with the Christian, this time specifically Christian, doctrine of incarnation. According to the incarnation, the doctrine of the incarnation, Jesus Christ, or rather, let's say first, the second person of the Trinity, assumed human nature, became a human being, suffered and died, rose from the dead, and the like. The important point here is the assumed human nature part. Now, there are two ways in which assuming human nature has been historically interpreted. On the one way, call this the concrete way, what it was for the second person of the Trinity to assume human nature was for the second person of the Trinity to get in an exceptionally close relation with a human being, with a human nature, Jesus, all right? So that these two beings, then, in the incarnation, there is, on the one hand, the second person of the Trinity, and on the other hand, this concrete human nature. And that's what it was for the incarnation to occur. On the other conception of assuming human nature is thought of not as a concrete object like Jesus of Nazareth, but rather as a property, the property of being human, an abstract object. So let's call that the abstract conception of the incarnation. On this conception, what happened was that the second person of the Trinity got a new property in the incarnation, assumed a new property, became a human being by virtue of exemplifying or now having the property of being a human being, which involves, among other things, having a body. All right? Now, why is there any difference here with respect to materialism? Well, the following. If to be a human being is to be a material object, then the second person of the Trinity, in becoming a human being, had to become a material object. That is, an immaterial thing, a thing that's not material at all. The second person of the Trinity had to actually become a material object. And that seems, at best, really hard to make sense of. Okay, so there is my argument, or there are my arguments. There are other philosophical arguments, and some of them seem to me to be really interesting arguments, really good arguments, but I don't have time to mention all of them now. The argument I did give seems to me to be a good argument, but I don't say it's absolutely conclusive. If there were really powerful arguments for materialism, well, then we'd have to reconsider. But as far as I know, there aren't any powerful arguments for materialism. As far as I know, there aren't even any decent arguments for materialism. So I say, so much the worse for materialism. Thank you.
Now you want to pose your questions, and you can pose them now. Raise your hands. Hi, I see Vishal in the back there. As your questions are posed, if Alvin, if you could just briefly repeat those questions so they can get on the tape, that'd be great. Way at the top there.
By what?
Biologically.
Biologically, yeah. Right. I suppose everybody else could hear that question just as well as I could, because...
Hate them.
Yeah. What's that? Oh, So the question... as I understand it, the question is... let's see if I really do understand this question. I guess the question is this the question, how could it be that a property of souls, namely being sinful, suffering from original sin, should be passed on biologically by virtue of genetic inheritance, where genetic inheritance seems to involve the body. It seems hard to see how that figures in with this property of the soul. I don't know what the answer to that question is. You know, for one thing, I don't know how it is that original sin does get transmitted, or even if it does get transmitted. The official Catholic view on this, on the question, what happens when a human being comes to be, is that God creates a new soul for this person de novo. So it's not that the soul would acquire the property of original sin by virtue of inheritance from the parents, somehow God would now create the soul with that property. Or at least God would create a new, create de novo a new soul. Possibly something connected with a body would bring it about that this soul suffered from original sin. But how that would go, I really don't know. That seems to me to be a genuine mystery as opposed to the mysteries Van Inwagen sees there. So I don't know what the answer to that is. But I don't think it suggests at all that human beings are not immaterial objects.
Hi, my name is Matt Stark, and I'd like to thank the McLaren Institute for having this program and for you being here. It's just been great fun, and I really enjoyed your presentation. I don't agree with you, but I enjoyed it. I happen to be an atheist, but that isn't the reason I disagree with you. It's that you argue on the basis of your definition of words, and I don't happen to agree. So you can define materialism in a way that you then can criticize it. But there are other ways of defining it, which then I might find more acceptable, except I don't have an hour to do it, other than to thank you very much, and this is very intellectually stimulating, and I'm delighted to be able to be here.
Well, let me, shall I respond to that? Now, did that get taped so I don't have to repeat it? Okay, yeah. Well, sure. I mean, I use words according to my own definitions. I mean, if I didn't use them according to my definitions, whose definitions would I use them according to? But I mean, how you define these words, that really isn't really relevant one way or the other. What counts is what it is you say by using the words. So what I wanted to criticize was materialism, defined the way I define materialism, as the idea that a human being just is a material object. You could use materialism to mean the idea that human beings have material bodies. Well, then, of course, I wouldn't be against materialism so taken at all. There'd be other definitions you could give of materialism, too, which might be such that I wouldn't be arguing against them. I just mean to be arguing against what I call materialism. And it seems to me that's the only way we can do things here.
Thank you. It seems to me that you have another issue to resolve, and that is that we find in the world that there are creatures which Christianity generally does not take to have souls, namely the higher animals, which seem to be capable of thought in the manner that you describe, and I'm interested in how you'd explain that from a dualist perspective.
Uh-huh. Right. Well, I've thought about that some, and I think that's a very good point and a very interesting point. Descartes, of course, you know, the sort of the father of modern dualism anyway, said that animals don't have souls and are mere machines. Well, I think that's implausible. I mean, it looks for all the world like your dog knows that you've now come home, not only knows that, but enjoys it. So that has at least two propositional attitudes towards the proposition he's home, namely A, believing, and B, liking. So what to say about that? I guess I'm inclined to think that in the case of animals, as in the case of human beings, animals really can think. And if they really can think, then they too have to be immaterial or have to have an immaterial part. I think that's a consequence. They don't have to have souls necessarily. Maybe a soul is a special kind of immaterial self, maybe one that is at least capable of moral judgments and capable of knowing God in some way, maybe capable of the sort of narrow image of God, holiness, righteousness, and the like. So maybe they don't have to have souls, but it seems to me it's hard to escape the thought that they do have to have some immaterial component that thinks.
Hi, I'm a physics major here at the university, and so rather interested in your comment about there being no answer to the question, how does an electron have a charge?
Yes.
And I was just curious as to how your argument would be affected if we physicists were to find a deeper answer to that question.
If physicists were to find a deeper answer to the question, Presumably the answer would be by discovering, or whatever it is that physicists actually do, by... ignore that. I have enormous respect for physics. But at its limits, it seems to me to be a whole lot more like sort of like a certain kind of speculative philosophy than like say the central parts of physics. But in any event, it would be presumably by discovering that electrons really are not simple, that they have parts, just as one discovers that that protons aren't simple but have parts. And then is having a charge would be explained in terms of the interaction of these parts. And that could happen. But then I'd want to make my point about these parts. Now, you might say one possibility here, one abstract possibility, is that it's, so to speak, complex all the way down. There aren't any simples in physics at all. There are quarks, but then there are parts of quarks which so far haven't shown up. Parts of those parts, all the way down, ad infinitum. Then there wouldn't be anything in physics that's simple. And then my particular example, I mean, it was just an example. My particular example wouldn't work. But I just find that really hard to imagine. I mean, I don't mean just to imagine. I find this really hard to think, the thought that there would be this whole infinite series of parts, of objects, all of which have parts, all the parts of which have parts, and so on, all the way down. I really can't make sense of that. There are some people who claim they can, but I'm inclined to think they're just boasting.
Again, I enjoyed the presentation quite a bit myself. I'm wondering whether you are committing yourself to the conclusion that not only is materialism false, but it's necessarily false, especially given what you say about us not being able, in a strong sense, to conceive of what it would be like for a physical being to have these mental states. And if so, then I'm a little bit puzzled. What should our disposition then be? If that, in fact, is the conclusion that we're to take from this, what should our disposition be with respect to arguments that people offer in favor of materialism?
Well, I mean, first of all, I guess I'd think that one would have to think the conclusions of those arguments are false. But I guess my conclusion is that materialism is necessarily false. The proposition that human beings are material objects is either necessarily true or necessarily false, I would say. Since it's not true at all, it's not necessarily true, and hence must be necessarily false. So the denial of materialism will be necessarily true. With respect to these arguments, then, first, I don't know of arguments that people. I really can't think of any arguments that people actually give for materialism. I mean, it's said to be, I guess what it is I don't think of any arguments I'm inclined to take seriously that people give for materialism. I mean, people do say things like, well, it fits in with science and materialism doesn't fit in with science and things like that. But with respect to these arguments, if I say that a certain proposition is necessarily true, I don't mean that it's obvious. There'll be lots of truths of mathematics that are necessarily true, like all truths of mathematics, and some might be so difficult that none of us could grasp them at all. Others might be such that we could only argue about them. We could never come to agreement about whether or not they were true, even though if they are true, they're necessarily true. Most philosophical conclusions are like that. So the fact that substance dualism, if true, is necessarily true, or anti-materialism, if true, is necessarily true, that doesn't mean that there's no sense in arguing about it, or that we can't argue about it is just going to be stupid or something like that. I mean, if to say it's necessarily true is not to say that it's epistemically necessary, it's just to say that it's ontologically necessary. And it might not be epistemically necessary at all. I mean, I don't say that it is. I don't say that I just know for a fact that materialists are wrong. I say I believe they're wrong. But I admit that, maybe something new will happen in the future that will lead me to think differently or lead others to think differently. I don't know if I quite caught your question, but if I did, then I think that's the answer.
Is there any particular reason why you reject the Aristotelian Thomistic mind-body argument, which is a one-substance theory, but argues very much that it is kind of the middle ground, I mean, that there isn't a compound, an immaterial power. The intellect is not a substance per se, but an immaterial power in one substantial form, which contains matter. You know, Adler,
yeah.
Maritain defend this and elaborate this, and they reject this dualism because of this angelic fallacy, as they call it.
Angelic fallacy?
Angelic fallacy of conceiving humans as being some kind of angel, some
uh-huh.
kind of pushing around a physical body for 70 years and then flying off back to heaven.
Well, that seems a little...
I mean, what's wrong with this mind-body argument, the Aristotelian
yeah.
Thomistic one?
I don't really understand it. That is, so you might say, well, on this, you might say a human being is matter informed by a certain form. Well, now, what is this form? Well, it's a property of a certain sort. I guess that's what a form in general would be. It would be a certain kind of property. So the form of a horse is the property of being a horse, let's say. So that's what it is then to be a human being. It's to be matter informed by this form. And so far, that would just be the assertion that human beings are material objects. However, Aquinas also says, and I don't quite know what Aristotle thinks about this, Aquinas also says the form can exist by itself. That is, the form, God can at least arrange things so that after this hylomorphic composite, this form-matter composite, no longer exists, the form still exists. The form still exists, and the form can think. Now, that's what I find really difficult. I mean, if a form is a property, how is it going to be able to think? You know, I mean, it isn't the kind of thing that can think. What thinks would be some kind of substance, a material substance, possibly, or an immaterial substance, but not just a property.
Well, the substance definition is a little bit more complex. I don't think I can completely explain the genesis of what Maritain and Adler did. But when you say think, I mean, they would accept that matter can think perceptually. Animals can engage in perceptual abstraction.
Animals,
no
yeah.
Perceptual thinking, no reflective thinking. That
right, but. Yeah.
And they would argue that the intellect very much is a soul that can be resurrected once the body has died by a miracle.
Well, but then
it can continue to persist, but it's not a one-substance field.
But then I guess I don't know what this form is. I thought I understood it initially. In Aristotle, you know, the simile is form and matter is timber and shape. You know, so you've got matter, but then it's got a certain property. It's got a certain shape in the original case, but many other kinds of properties as well. So I think, as far as I can make out, a form has got to be a property. But I don't think a property can think, even if it's not immersed in matter, even if it's not characterizing a given bit of matter or any given bit of matter. I don't see how, if it's a property, how it can think. It's not the right sort of thing. So I guess my real problem here is that I would really like to be able to understand Aquinas' view on these matters, but after trying at some length for some years, I really can't. I don't understand it. I have read that, but I think Aquinas is a lot more acute on it, really, than Maritain. I'm sorry, not Maritain. Yeah, right. Yeah, a lot more acute than Adler. I mean, this Aquinas writes about this at considerable length, and on this, as on many other topics, he's very much worth thinking very hard about. But on this topic, I really can't make sense out of what he says. Maybe some good Thomist here could.
Hi.
Yeah.
Are you a
Thomist?
No, sir. a different sort of question. I am a Seventh-day Adventist, and as I'm sure you're well aware, various denominations that derive from the Millerite movement hold to conditional immortality of the soul, where the soul is raised on the last day, or the body is raised and the soul becomes complete, and then will live forever with Christ, or
right.
Annihilationism also is often present with this, where soul is destroyed in hell rather than living forever as an independent entity. My question right. for you is, can this Adventist, and it's present in some other denominations too, belief be characterized as a materialist belief, or is it actually more of a dualist belief where the spirit is not immortal, separate, or how would I say this? The spirit has life and thinking and so on only when present with a body.
Right. Yeah.
Goes into some form of a sleep or something.
Yes.
At death. Where does soul sleep or conditional immortality fit on this?
It would be a kind of dualism, a kind of substance dualism. It would be the kind according to which a soul, a self, very much needs a body to be complete. So you might contrast, say, Christian immaterialism or dualism with Platonic dualism. According to Plato, you know, Socrates says when he's facing death that death is a really good thing. It frees the body, the soul, from the prison house of the body. And then the soul can dwell with the forms and look at the forms without being hindered and held back by this miserable, heavy body. But that's not the Christian way of looking at the matter, I would say. Rather, it's that death is an unnatural wrenching apart of body and soul. And the soul without a body is incomplete. It's not in a good condition. It's not in its natural condition. What happens at the last day when your soul gets the body again is there is then completion. But in the meantime, one possible view is a soul doesn't even succeed in thinking, maybe not even conscious, during the time when it's not embodied. Or another idea might be it does think, but only in a kind of confused way. It doesn't have anything like the powers it does have when it's associated properly with a body. Right.
Yeah, the reason that substance dualism, as far as I know, is almost universally rejected in the scientific world and certainly in psychology. Wilder Penfield was a dualist, but he died, I think, in the 70s. And I don't know of anybody now within psychology who will publicly defend it. And the reason that they give is that, as Fraser Watts puts it, there's been a tightening of the mind or the body-mind connection. So that in things like Alzheimer's disease, the disease affects the person's thinking, their whole consciousness. And so the assumption in the sciences is that our consciousness and our thinking is rooted in the materiality of our minds. That seems to be the argument. I've read in theology and science, I've done a lot of work in this, and it's, it seems to be just about universally accepted. How would you respond to that?
Well, I would respond by saying what we actually know is that the body's being in a certain kind of condition or state is a necessary condition of thinking. So if you rap somebody sharply on the head, that person won't be thinking. And we've known that for a long time. It didn't take modern psychology to teach us that. So we know that. So what we do know, and what we learned more about recently, is the extent of this. There's an intimate dependence of thinking, mental function, functioning generally, on the body. Maybe that's intrinsic to the soul. Maybe that's the way it is. Maybe so, as I was saying a moment ago, maybe if a soul didn't have a body, it wouldn't be able to think at all. Maybe not. I don't know. But at any rate, in the present condition, that's the way it is. But that's not for an instant to suggest that it's the body itself that thinks. All that says is a necessary condition of thinking is that the body be in a certain condition. To have that other conclusion, we'd have to have not just that it's a necessary condition, but that it's a sufficient condition, and we don't have that.
Hey, I'm here. Hi, I'm August Berkshire. I'm president of Minnesota Atheists. Don't you think your entire argument is God of the gaps or soul of the gaps? That basically you're just saying you don't know how the natural world or material things can create a consciousness, and indeed nobody knows that at this present moment. That only moves the argument into the unknown, and all of a sudden you're postulating that a soul did it or does it without any evidence for a soul. So isn't that just soul of the gaps?
Well, here's the evidence for one evidence for souls, namely where a soul is an immaterial thing that thinks, namely it looks like no material thing can think. And if no material thing can think, then since clearly there's thinking, it must be that some immaterial thing thinks. That would basically be the structure of the argument. There isn't anything like that on the other side. It's not that it looks as if it's impossible that an immaterial thing think. That doesn't look impossible at all. So if it looks impossible, and if it looks that way, I mean, maybe it is that way. That's basically the argument.
Hi, I also wanted to thank you for coming tonight. I was wondering, when you say that it's not that we just don't know how a material thing would think, but we can actually see that it's logically impossible that it could.
Right.
I was wondering how you would explain emergent properties or things that come about when certain subsystems are brought together, like the wetness of water, when the molecules of the water itself or the atoms or the electrons don't contain wetness in and of themselves. I was wondering how you would respond to the soul just being an emergent property.
There's one possibility here that might fit what you're thinking. There's a philosopher named William Hasker who is a dualist, and he thinks that selves or souls supervene on bodies and on bodily characteristics. The idea is when you get a certain level of neural complexity, then somehow a soul just pops into being, and that it does is a necessary truth. That would be a kind of really, what should we say, extreme emergentism, but it would be totally, but it is a kind of dualism. It's not just compatible with dualism, it really is a kind of dualism. Now, the kind that would be more relevant to what you seem to have in mind would be this. You'd say, as you get more and more complex things, you get more and more new properties. And eventually you get the property of thinking, but still it's just a material object that does the thinking. I would say that, of course, it's true that when you have parts together, working together in a certain way, you wind up with properties of the whole that none of the parts have. That happens all the time. Like the parts might be 2 inches long, but the whole might be 4 inches long. That's very easy to understand. But it's not easy to understand. In fact, it seems to me you can see that this can't happen, that just by virtue of that kind of working together of material parts, you wind up with the thought that, say, naturalism is all the rage these days. All right, so in essence, the answer is, yeah, there are emergent properties, but this property is one such that it looks like it couldn't emerge in that fashion.
Question up in this area?
In arguing for dualism, all you did was say that materialism cannot happen, so dualism is the only other option. But couldn't we have something else, say, for instance, a monism that is not exactly materialistic, that have some sort of mind-like properties that are latent and come about in a human brain? I think that we have good scientific evidence that we have to have some sort of monism as well because, for instance, brain damage studies, there's different parts of the brain that correspond to different parts of the mind. And when those parts of the brain are damaged, those parts of the mind are damaged.
Yes. That's certainly right. When you damage certain parts of the brain, you also bring about the cessation of certain kinds of mental function. But I can't see how that's any particular evidence for some sort of monism. I mean, that's perfectly compatible with dualism. It's not like it selects between monism and dualism, perfectly compatible with it. One kind of monism one might consider would go contrary to one thing I said. I said one thinks that simples like electrons and quarks don't think. Now, my argument does really nothing to show that simples like electrons and quarks, that kind of physical simple, does nothing to show that such things don't think. I was just taking for granted that they didn't think. And all my argument really shows is that you won't get thinking, I mean, if it's a successful argument, what it shows is you won't get thinking by virtue of the physical interaction of parts. So it won't be that a thing which has parts thinks by virtue of the way those parts fit together. That is what my argument really precludes. But it doesn't preclude the thought that physical simples can think. And if I were to be a materialist, I think that's the kind I'd want to be. I want to say what a human being really is a physical simple, like an electron or a quark.
Okay, we'll take one more question over here. I'm sorry. I know that many of you want to get in on this.